Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm Ari Ariel, the host of the channel, and today I'll be talking to Abigail Jacobson and Moshe Naor about their new book, Oriental Neighbors, Middle Eastern Jews and Arabs in Mandatory Palestine. Abigail is the academic director of the Mediterranean Neighbors Program at the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem, and Moshe is an assistant professor in the Department of Israel Studies at the University of Haifa. Abigail, Moshe, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Ari.
Yeah, hi.
So I wonder if we could begin by telling us a little bit about your backgrounds. How did you decide to work together, and how did you decide to do this book?
So I came to this topic as, in a way, a continuation of my first book project. The first book dealt with the Jerusalem in the transition between Ottoman and British mandatory rule, and one of the chapters there dealt with the question of the complex identities of the Sephardi community in Jerusalem. And this is where I started thinking more critically about this, the question of complexity of identities and trying to break the binaries and the dichotomies between Jews and Arabs, Jewish identity, Arab identity, and trying to understand more the complexities of the what does it mean to be a Jew coming from the Middle East, speaking Arabic, thinking in Arabic, and feeling part of this Middle Eastern or Mediterranean milieu in the context of Palestine. So for me, it was really a continuation of an already existing interest in a way.
Yeah, so we started the project in 2011 on the background of the outbreak of the Arab Spring. And I think that one of the reasons that me and Abigail joined together with this project was the idea to connect Israeli and Jewish history with the Middle Eastern history, and also in a very optimist atmosphere that was started in this year. And it also was part, as Abigail mentioned, part of my research on the 48th war and also the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, but also from personal reasons that are related to the discourse today and in the last years in Israel about the status of Israel as part of the Middle East, the status of the Jews from Middle Eastern countries, and the status of a Mizrahi identity or Arab Jews identity or Sephardi Jews identity that all were related and were exposed as part of the discourse in Israel in the year 2011, but also before that. But this event also were part of the question that me and Abigail were asking ourselves, and this led to the cooperation with this book.
A lot of the past literature seems to have assumed that the Yeshuva and Palestinian society were completely separate during the Mandate period. So I guess what you're saying is to reinsert the Yeshuv into the Middle East, you're using Arab-Jewish interaction. Is that something you did consciously?
Yes, it was very conscious. The integration of Palestine, Eretz Israel, into the Middle East is also part of the rationale for our own collaboration as scholars. I'm coming from Middle Eastern studies, Palestinian history, and Moshe is a historian of the Yeshuv, the Zionist movement of Israel. By cooperating together, we're trying to say, to kind of make a statement here that the history of this area, which is mixed, should be integrated into the region.
Yes. So this was one of the main arguments about, as Abigail mentioned, about placing Palestine in the broader context of the Middle East. And also what we try to do is to challenge the dual society thesis. When we speak about Arab-Jewish relations in the history of the late Ottoman Empire and then in Mandatory Palestine, it's also important to compare it to the status of Jews under Islamic rule or in Arab states. And when we discuss and compare this concept about Jews in Middle Eastern countries and Arab countries, and Jews and Arabs in Mandatory Palestine, usually in research the focus and was for years based on the dual society concept that described the relations between Jews and Arabs as a dual society, meaning that both communities develop in parallel direction. and that almost in any aspects of life, economical, political, social, and cultural, we speak about two societies with less than very few connections. And this was the dominant concept and thesis for years. Now, we can find in historical research, also sociological, attempts to challenge the dual society concept. One of them is about post-colonialist studies that were part of the subject of research on our Jewish relations, and also about intercommunal or joint theses that try to focus mainly on economic aspects. Now, me and Abigail, in this project, we try to challenge the dual society in some way, and also the main research about this issue from a new approach that for us was very important, and this is the approach of the Sephardi and the Oriental Jews. And our argument was, and this is what how we started the research, that by focusing on the Oriental Jews, on the Sephardi Jews, we can challenge the assumption of a dual society. And from this point of view, we can also understand and see maybe a different angle and different perspective, not only about our Jewish relations, but also about the history of Zionism and also the connection of Palestine with the broader Middle East.
Maybe it's worth just saying a word about terminology, too, particularly for English language listeners. How did you choose the term Oriental here?
So we had a huge debate about it. We obviously, the community we're talking about, the group we're talking about, is very, very heterogeneous. And we're talking about a group that consists of Sephardi Jews, of Jews who were born in Palestine, about Jews coming from North Africa, Maghrebi Jews, about Yemenites, about Bukharis coming from about a very large group of people. We had a problem. We didn't want to call the book, you know, to only focus on the Sephardi Jews, because this would be wrong. The book deals with different groups, different perspectives, and by no means we're trying to create any kind of one monolithic argument. On the contrary, we're trying to highlight the complexities and the nuances of all these, of all the different groups we're talking about, all the different communities we're talking about. So we were trying, when choosing the name of the book, we're trying to, in a way, you know, present or choose a title that would be a little bit more, let's say, general. Let's put it this way, but also and not too specific. Even though, and it's also important to mention here, the book also touches and deals, some of the figures, let's say, that the book deals with and focuses on are not Oriental at all. I mean, they are Oriental, but they are Ashkenazi. Some of them are Ashkenazi Jews born and raised in Palestine. Some are mixed, you know, coming from mixed families, as far as the Ashkenazi. So there's a very, very complex kind of demographic profile that we're talking about here.
Yes, I will add also that usually in the period of the mandate, the three categories that were used by the statistic department of the Jewish agency and other discourse was about the category of Sephardi Jews, descendants of Jews from Spain, the Oriental Jews, mainly Jews that spoke Arabic, and also Persian, and mainly from Middle Eastern countries. And the third category was mainly the Yemenite Jews. These were the three categories that we can find in this field. Now, as Abigail mentioned, it's a community that is dominated by the Sephardi Jews as they live, but also about the Oriental Jews that we call today Mizrahim. Now, part of this description and the use of the title of Oriental Jews, this was actually the term that the Jews, the Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews, used in this period. For example, we have one of the most important newspaper or journal called Eda Mizrah, Echo of the East, and the term that we can find in this journal, in their news, in their publications in English, they use the term Oriental Jews. So this was the translation of the period, and we, as historians, were committed to this concept and this terminology, And we adopted this, the terminology that people of the period used and the group that we were focusing on.
So you begin with the Sephardic elite, and you talk about a transformation of power, maybe a decline of the politics of notables with the British Mandate. Could you talk about that a little and how that transformation affected the elite?
Yeah, sure. So we start the book by basically, in a way, connecting it to the previous historical period, if you may, of Ottoman Palestine. And what we see in Ottoman Palestine is that during as part of the millet system of the Ottoman Empire, the Sephardi Jews, as the Ottoman citizens living in Palestine at the time, were considered to be the representatives of the Jewish community in the country vis-a-vis the Ottoman authorities and the central administration in Istanbul. And so they held really a very important and central political role, again, vis-a-vis the Ottomans. Now, with the transition to the mandatory rule, what happens is that obviously the Ottoman Empire, has disappeared, is no longer there. And this group of usually elite, as Moshe said, elite, a notable group of Sephardim, lost its position of power and influence within the country's political sphere and arena. This is also part, of course, of the changes that were taking place with the rising power of the hegemonic Zionist Ashkenazi Second Aliyah leadership, of the way the British dealt with with the ethno-national divisions in the country, etc. And so one of the arguments that we're making in the book is that this group of Sephardi Jews, the elite Sephardi Jews, were looking and were trying to find a different role to themselves and, in a way, create and reconfigure themselves or redefine themselves politically and find a new political project. And one of those political projects that they found was to adopt this idea and role for themselves as mediators. And one of the big things and the big themes that we're working on in the book is this theme of mediation in a very critical way, of course. But the book is basically dealing with different spheres of mediation, trying to see how this very, very complex group of people, a very heterogeneous group of people, was trying to kind of redefine itself, relocate itself as mediators, arguing that they are the ones, based on their language, the fact that they know Arabic, the fact that they feel familiar and are very, very comfortable in the Middle East, in the Arab countries, etc., that they are the ones that can actually bridge between the hegemonic Zionist leadership and the Arab community, the Arab national movement at the time.
Yeah, so we can add to it also that what happened after the First World War, that the Sephardi and also the Oriental Jews leadership was used to a system that didn't exist anymore. And it's also part of a social structure and political structure that changed during the Mandate period. So if you can find the Jewish leadership in other Arab countries, in Iraq or in Egypt, in Syria, and so on, we can see that the Sephardi leadership continued to have their status as part of the system under colonial rule. It's true that it's a different situation compared to the Ottoman period. But in Palestine, the same group, the same people that were used to have their role, political, social, cultural, based on urban notables and based on the system that was existed as the representative of the Jewish community with the Ottoman leadership, now lost their status. And here it's about their attempt, as Abigail just mentioned, to find how they can adapt to the new changes and what will be their new role in a new social and political structure.
So as they attempt to adjust themselves and position themselves as mediators between the Jewish and Arab communities, how do the Arab-Palestinian communities react to that?
Okay, so here, first it's about their role as a historical, and they saw it also as a mission, historical mission, to be a mediator, the one that can bridge between Arab and Jews, the one that, based on their in-between status or hybrid Arab-Jewish hybrid communities, can bridge and to mediate between Jews and Arabs. And this was the main mission that they saw as a self-perception of their status. Now, we have here the response from the Jewish leadership, but also from Arab national leaders like Jamal al-Husseini and others, that for them, the Oriental Jews were regarded to be as the natives of the land, Bnei Haaretz. And this status of Ottoman citizens and people that are native of the land and are rooted in Palestine was part of arguments and that we can find during the mandate period, especially from Arab and Palestinian Arab speakers and leaders that describe the Oriental Jews as non-Zionists. We can find a few examples from the beginning of the mandate and also in the 30s and 40s describing them as non-loyal Zionists. One that can be connected and be part of a concept of a Palestinian identity and nationalism, and one that called them to abandon the Zionist ideology and join the Arab, the Christian and Muslims, Arabs in Palestine, to be part of one national identity. And this argument placed the Oriental Jews, and the Sephardi Jews, when mentioning about Oriental, in a difficult situation. Now, their description will be mainly that they are Zionists, and we can speak later about what kind of Zionism. What was their perception of Zionism? But they were placed in a very difficult situation.
To what extent was that successful? Meaning that their defensive position then is to reaffirm their loyalty to Zionism. So, are they integrated into the Zionist administrative, levels in any serious way?
So the first two chapters of the book basically deal with the political dimension of this mediation project. And what we show in these two chapters is that the Oriental Jews actually do not present one cohesive and united, if you may, political line. They are active in different organizations. They're active in different political movements, different political parties. We can find some people who are active at the revisionist movement, for example, and we can find some who are active in the very, using today's terminology, left-wing movements such as Brit Shalom and Kedma Mizracha. But so they're not presenting one coherent and united political agenda. But what unites them and what we keep seeing in their discourse, in their writing, in the way they communicate with the British and with the Zionist organization, etc., is that they are the ones who have the ability to really bridge between Jews and Arabs in the country, to bridge between the Zionist movement that doesn't really understand what is happening in the Arab world, doesn't really understand what is happening with the rise and growth of the Palestinian National Movement. So to bridge between them and between the Palestinians themselves.
Yeah, so also part of their, what you can say about their identity of being Zionist, so for leaders of the Sephardi Oriental Jews, for them they were practical Zionists. So the claim that they are not Zionists was rejected, of course, by them. And they described themselves as not true, not part of political Zionism, but as practical Zionism that had connection to the land of Israel long before Herzl and the establishment of the Zionist movement. And we can find a few examples and in the discourse of the mandatory period, again and again, they describe themselves as real Zionists, Zionists that lived in the Middle East, were connected to the Holy Land and to Jerusalem, the one that continued to live in the area, And that one that could be described as a practical Zionist. And we can find it in several occasions, but it was mainly part of their discourse that was responding to Zionist leadership, but also to Palestinian claims that they are not Zionists.
Let me just add to what Moshe said earlier. They were placed oftentimes in a very problematic position because they had to prove again and again their loyalty to the Zionist movement and to Zionism, because the Zionists, the hegemonic Zionist leadership and different figures there continued to basically look at them very suspiciously, saying, and this is connected to what you asked earlier about the Palestinian leadership, you know, kind of suspecting in their true loyalty, whether they are true Zionists, whether they are loyal Zionists, etc. And so they had to kind of prove their loyalty time and time again, their loyalty to the Zionist movement. So part of this book actually also deals not only with Jewish-Arab relations and with the relations between Palestine and the surrounding Middle East, but it also deals and complicates the relations and the internal dynamics within the Zionist movement itself and the tensions that we can find within the Zionist movement itself.
Some of the major figures you talk about, for example, Sassoon, are really fascinating in the sort of tensions and contradictions that they themselves embody, right? So he seems to have written for Arab Nationalist publications and then also Zionist publications, and he's interested in mediation, but also works in a security role. How do they reconcile those sort of tensions and ambivalences?
Yeah, so before speaking about Eliyahu Sassoon and as a model of character, only to add about the last point that as Abigail mentioned, we can find the Oriental Sephardi Jews in labor Zionism, in revisionist Zionism, and so on. And one of their the problem of their status, political status, one of the main problems was about that they tried to be not part of categories. They weren't describe themselves as part of right or left in political terms. Also, you can speak about categories of being religious and secular. They didn't fit to these categories. And what they tried to do in the mandate, they tried to avoid this categorization and being part of, associated with the left or the right wing. And they try also to create their own political parties that were described mainly by the labor Zionism that led the Zionist movement since the 30s as a separation, as a separatist. And here we can find those arguments about being an ethnic minority even. And as Abigail mentioned, it was the inter-political struggle, but also social aspects of the Jewish community in Palestine as being part of this community. And here we have the example of Eliyahu Sassoon, that it's a fascinating story of life, one that was among the circles of Faisal in Damascus in the late First World War, a person that arrived to Palestine later in the late 20s, and in his article that we used in the book that were published in Arabic newspapers, he criticized the Zionist leadership. He criticized the approach to the Arab, what is called the Arab question in this time as part of the Jewish discourse. And we can see his way from this criticism to become the head of the Arab Bureau in the political department of the Jewish Agency. And Eliyahu Sassoon is history from the circles of Faisal, from the Jewish community in Damascus to Palestine, and to become one of the main persons that was responsible of leading the negotiation between Jews and Arabs is a fascinating story that also describes a character or identity of an Arab Jew.
So Eliyahu Sassoon is one figure that we're focusing on. We are focusing also on other figures which have this very, very complex an ambivalent identity, which is full of contradictions in many ways. We look at the role of mistarvim, of Jews who were recruited by the paramilitary groups, by the Haganah, the Etzel, the Lehi, to become to become spies or to you know, plant bombs, to be involved in all kinds of espionage activities within the surrounding Middle East, using a kind of an identity in cover, using the fact that they speak Arabic fluently, that they have an Arabic accent, that they look Arabs, right? That they have the image of an Arab, if you can speak of something like that. And what we show and what we demonstrate in the book is that they themselves adopted as their names for those kind of operations undercover, they adopted their names from the period in which they lived in the Arab world. Okay, and they have this whole ambivalence, identity in a way, identity ambivalence in which they kind of, on the one hand, served, of course, the Zionist agenda, the mission of the Zionist movement, used their special, let's say, characteristics to serve the Zionist movement, but on the other hand, felt very, very much at home in the different countries and the different cities that they ended up in, including, for example, Beirut, Cairo, different cities in Palestine, etc.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating argument because it sounds almost like security becomes a form of mediation for them. I mean, maybe I'm pushing that too far, but what would you say about that?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's actually what we argue in the book, and as you can see, the chapters, each chapter leads to other chapter because it's a dialogue between different mediation levels, and we are focusing on political mediation, social, cultural, and also we call it security mediation. And exactly this subject of the Arabized Jews, or the Arabized Mustarvim, as they called them before Mustarvim, it's part of this Arab-Jewish identity that was exist in the Middle East, but also in Mandatory Palestine. Now, we were focusing mainly on communities that lived in neighborhoods in the mixed cities, that the Jews that were operating in this security mediation a joint Jews that immigrated from Arab countries, and both of them were part of a we call it crossing the borders of crossing the lines in security terms, but also the lines of their identity as between a Jewish and Arab identity, that that their operation and their role in security aspects kept this identity alive.
And we of course look at this. You know, you cannot compare the security aspects of the mediation, let's say the mediatory role as the security agents, to the political aspects or to other aspects. We're looking at different types of mediation and look at them very, very critically, not naively, not nostalgically, but are trying really to examine what does it mean to be a mediator in all these spheres of operation.
So one of the other really important spheres seems to be the cultural sphere, and that seems focused to some extent on Arabic language, on writing and publishing in Arabic and teaching Arabic in the issue. And there's sort of a standard argument that Zionist publishing in Arabic is a form of propaganda, but you both argue something quite different.
Right. So we look at the sphere of the cultural sphere, or what we call cultural politics. And we're trying to examine basically three spheres of operation. One is through the Arabic newspapers, and newspapers published in Arabic, both in Palestine as well as in other Arab cities and countries. And many of these newspapers were published with the support of the Zionist movement. Many of these newspapers had those Oriental Jews as either writers or editors of, and we're trying to look at these newspapers as a sphere and an arena of communication and transmitting of knowledge and ideas both between Jews and Jews and fellow Jews in the Arab world, as well as between Jews in the Arab world and in Palestine, as well as, of course, between Jews and Arabs. Now, this is one sphere of cultural operation. The other sphere that we've examined is the issue of translation, of literary translations from Arabic to Hebrew, in order for the the idea behind this is to expose the Jewish community in Palestine to Arabic literature and to this kind of cultural dimension of the Arab world. And the third aspect that we're looking at is the issue of Arabic studies and the debates about how to teach Arabic in Palestine, how to whether to emphasize the teaching of Fusha or Amiya, colloquial or standard Arabic, what is more important, what is the role of those Oriental Jews in teaching Arabic, whether it is important for them to teach Arabic, to stand in front of a group of students and speak Arabic to them. What is the purpose of this? And our argument is we here in this chapter, we talk and argue in a way. We look at the other arguments that were posed in the literature about such questions, such as, for example, those of Lior Halperin or Yoni Mendel or Gil Eyal also, in a way, that this kind of cultural mediation or of writing in Arabic is really a form of propaganda. And propaganda for the Zionist movement, of course. And what we argue is that, in fact, when looking at these spheres, the cultural sphere, the newspaper, the translations, etc., as also cultural spheres and not only as political spheres, the picture is much more complex. And here we're looking not only at propaganda per se, but also again as some kind of a form of explaining, of bridging, of exposing the Jewish population, the Jewish community in Palestine to other aspects in the Arab world, and also exposing the Arabs to the complexities and the questions that are raised within the Zionist movement.
Yeah. So when we look at the background of editors of newspapers that were written in Arabic by Jews, and if we look who were the Arabic teachers, we can find the Ashkenazi Jews, but also Sephardic and Oriental Jews, that this was part of their Arab Jewish identity. And as we just mentioned, this was part of the role that could be described as propaganda. But in the same time, when we look exactly about their background and about their identity, we get a different perspective and different point of view. And for example, if we look at about the Arabic teachers, we are focusing on Shimon Somer, for example, one of the important figures of this period, that was an Arabic teacher that immigrated from Iraq and later found himself to be the main instructor of the Palmach, the Arab Bureau of the Palmach, and the main leader of the Mistar Arvin, the Arabized Jews in the Palmach. And his example of a Jew that immigrated from Iraq, was a teacher connected to Eliyahu Sasson, Eliyahu Agassi, and other, and becoming part of the military wing of the Jewish community, is another example of this complex of identities and conflict.
So, and that sort of ambivalence between mediation and identity and conflict really is played out very much in the fourth chapter on mixed neighborhoods, and particularly you focus on Kerem HaTimanim. But so taking it down a notch, maybe from the cultural sphere, in the daily lives of Jews and Arabs that lived in mixed neighborhoods, were these neighborhoods sites for interaction or coexistence, or were they filled with confrontation, or how did life play out?
So it's actually both, and that's exactly the interesting story here. So we're focusing on there's a lot of literature and a lot of scholarship, of course, written on the mixed neighborhoods in Palestine, in the mixed cities in Palestine. What we are doing is looking specifically at what is called often called the Oriental ghettos, the frontier neighborhoods, which were on the border between the Jewish and Arab parts of the city, or between a Jewish and Arab two Jewish and Arab cities. Specifically, one of our main examples, as you mentioned, is the Kerem HaTeimanim, the Yemenite orchard, or the Yemenite neighborhood in Tel Aviv, in the southern part of Tel Aviv, which bordered with the neighborhood of Manshiye. And we are looking at these neighborhoods as a place of interaction, of meeting, of neighborhood relationships between Jews, mainly from Oriental background, and Arabs. The interesting thing about that characterizes them is the fact that that most of the residents, inhabitants of these neighborhoods, come from a very low socioeconomic status. So they, you know, are very, very different in a way from those we talked about earlier, the notables and the elite, the Sephardi elite. Here we're talking about Yemenite workers. Or Arab merchants, but very, very coming from very low socioeconomic status. And what we demonstrate here is how through their daily interactions, on the one hand, they live side by side, sometimes at the same house, sometimes they share the same courtyard, sometimes they live in the same street. They live very, very close, in close neighborly relations to each other, but at the same time, they also have a lot of tensions, many, many tensions and conflicts based mainly on the national level. Interestingly enough, it was from these neighborhoods that those paramilitary organizations recruited those mistarvim, the Arabized Jews, who later on served mainly in the 30s after the Arab revolt, served in the different units that we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So it was, there were, for example, looking at Kerem HaTeimanim, there were many Yemenite Jews who were recruited to the Lehi and to the Palmach to serve in their different Mistarvim units. So here again, we show this complexity, the nuances, the very, very delicate relationship, and the different mechanisms of crossing those, again, if we spoke earlier about frontiers and about borders, here we're looking also at geographical boundaries between the mixed cities, how people crossed between Tel Aviv and Jaffa, what were the different mechanisms of connections. So this is part of the argument over there.
Yeah, so while we were focusing in the three chapters on the elite, on the hybrid Arab-Jewish identity that was described in the cultural and political spheres, in the fourth and fifth chapters, actually, again, as we mentioned, it's part of a different level of hybrid identity. And here those neighborhoods, the frontier neighborhoods, between, as we mentioned, in Jaffa and Haifa and so on, but it's also about other cities that were regarded with the periphery, like Tiberias. And here we can find exactly examples of coexistence, living together in these areas, and at the same time also expression of tensions and conflict. Now, during this period, like happened during the Arab revolt, later in the 48th war, we can find that Jews and Arabs found refugee in the centers of Jaffa or Tel Aviv, in the examples of these cities. And the Jews that fled in this period were described by the Jewish community in Tel Aviv as Oriental culture, Jews that came from a different level of culture that the Yishuv recognized. And we can find in the discourse and description of them as the Arab Jews. And it's very interesting to compare their status, economic and social, to their neighbors, to the Arab Muslims and Cushing neighbors.
And there's also, am I right, that there's also a generational shift here, so that now we're talking about sort of younger Oriental Jews who were either born in the Mandate period or immigrated from the Arab world?
Exactly. So there are basically different categories here, or different shifts that we're talking about here. There is a generational shift between the generation of the parents, between those who were educated, grew up under the Ottoman rule, under the Ottoman umbrella, let's say, that shaped their identities in a certain way, and the generation of the sons, who grew up already during the mandatory years when the conflict, the national conflict in the country increased. So we have this shift going on. We also have the geographical shift between the cities of Jerusalem, which was the kind of the more traditional and the political center of the Ottoman Sephardi activity, to the city of Tel Aviv, that became the center, the political center of the younger generation of leadership, that was also more extreme in a way politically.
Yes, so we can add also to the tensions between Tel Aviv, and the center in Tel Aviv, to the center in Jerusalem, and the tension and between the new generation to the old Sephardic generation, also to tensions between Sephardi Jews and Mizrahim, and Oriental Jews, between Jews that came from Arab countries to the Sephardi Jews. And you can find parallel between Jerusalem and Jaffa, and between elite and other circles of the society, also to their origin and identity as Oriental Jews compared to Sephardi Jews. And you can find it also in the 30s and 40s, the emergence of this kind of tension.
So I wonder, we started out by, you said one of the influences for the book was 2011 and the Arab Spring. So I'm wondering if you can just reflect on what this says about contemporary Arab relations. And I'm wondering, particularly because as I read through parts of the book, for example, Avisar's proposal for a political union of two states that are connected in some ways, it sounded a lot to me like current proposals for confederalism. So I'm wondering in what way maybe you can reflect on the contemporary situation.
So the contemporary mainly... I must say it's about it's part of a discourse in Israel that is related to also the status and the history of the Jews from Arab countries. For example, only in 2014, actually in 2014, there was an issue of a new memorial day in Israel, marking the departure and expulsion of the Jews from Arab countries. And in Israel, they mark it and remember this day on the 30th of November, 2 weeks ago, actually 2 weeks ago. And this is very interesting, a change in Israeli discourse that expels the growing interest and knowledge about the Jews from Arab countries, that we can find it in films and literature, also in political aspects. And of course, there's a political reason for this day. But we have to remember that there is a discourse that speaks about the identity and the history of Jews from Arab countries that was neglected and was silent and was mute in Israeli literature and historiography. And one of our aims is to place these voices back to the center of the Israeli discourse. And we are part of the changes that we can find the book as part of these changes and trends of discourse. Now, regarding Arab-Jewish relations, the situation in Israel, it's part of this discourse. And of course, we can think here about the status of the Sephardi and Oriental Jews that are in between, or used to be in between, in the history of Palestine and later in the state of Israel. And also asking, and this is a question that we raised about if this was a road that was not taken, and also maybe from this kind of perspective, maybe there was another option for the solution of our Arab-Israeli conflict, although we are not, we don't have any ambitious, speaking about political solutions, but mainly about the importance of understanding each group, each other, understanding both culture, and understanding that both communities had a lot of share in common. And as historians, this is one of our aims, to remember and to place this memory.
I also think it's very important to not to forget and not to silence the connection here between the politics and the identity issue and the kind of cultural complexity that we're presenting in the book. I mean, the oftentimes in today's, especially political discourse in Israel, the kind of the Mizrahi card or the Oriental card is being raised, which is and is completely disconnected from the political aspect of things and from the conflict. And I think that this book tries to bring together both issues and both dimensions together. And it's important to mention we're really trying to avoid nostalgia here. We're not trying to romanticize the Oriental Jews. We're looking at them very, very critically while trying to expose their very unique, the way we see it, a very, very unique aspect and perspective, both towards the ethnic tensions, relations within the Jewish issue, within the Zionist movement, but also, of course, between Jews and Arabs in general.
So I think we've taken up too much of your time already. Could either of you tell me what you're working on now, what sort of projects you have going?
So I'm working actually now about mainly the Mitzvah government in the Israeli mixed cities in the early 50s, and also about the League of Saving the Jews from Arab Countries that was part of discourse in the 50s about the status of Jews in Arab countries. So I'm in some way also continue the same approach that me and Abigail started in this book, but mainly focusing on major government in the 50s, but also about the connection of Israeli politics in this period to the status of the Jews from Arab countries.
And I'm trying to return and complete a project that I started before this book started about the Arab faction of the Palestinian Communist Party, the National Liberation League. That's a project that I started working on and urgently need to finish and publish.
Those both sound like really interesting projects. I look forward to seeing them. This book was really wonderful. Everybody should go out and purchase it and reading it. And I want to thank you guys both for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Ari. Bye.